examination. The examination will be given in this room at 1:25 in the afternoon. I checked that, but that's the faculty ruling. The examination will be administered by Mr. William Schmeling. It will be an objective examination. It'll consist partly of true-false questions, partly of matching questions, partly of fill-in questions, partly of multiple choice. There will be several parts to the examination. One part will allow for substitution. In other words, you may choose, as you will find when you see the examination in hand tomorrow, you'll see that you have an option to substitute one section, let us say section C, which will consist of approximately 20 questions, for section D, which will also consist of approximately 20 questions. And what's the difference between the two sections? The one section consists of questions based upon the class lectures, and the other section consists in questions based upon optional outside readings, which you may have chosen to do. If you've done the outside readings and you feel that on the strength of those readings, you can answer the questions in this particular alternate section that I'm speaking about, then you may elect to answer the questions in that section rather than electing to answer the questions which are based on the class lectures. All the other questions in the examination, however, for which there is no substitution, are based on the class lectures. I take it as an act of providence that we've had every single word of the lectures which have been given in this course, not only by Dr. Meyer and by me, but also by Mr. Otting, which is most important, taped. We didn't quite know why we did it at the beginning of the quarter, now we know. And I've been playing some of those back last night again. Some things, I suppose, are just as well not immortalized, but it's just among us chickens, so it can do no harm. I mean, I'm not referring to anything which he said. Some of the things that some of the rest of us have said. Somehow, it sounds altogether different, you know, when you're sitting in a plush study at home in the presence of your wife and children. Another cue for tomorrow's examination. I see Bill Schultz walking in. Bill, may I see you after class, please? Is that the examination questions begin with the unit on the theology of the Middle Ages. By the way, will it be easier for you to see the outline on the overhead projector if we close a few more of the draperies, or especially if we close those up front altogether? Let's do that, huh? As we close the gap. Mr. Doobie, would you turn off the lights, please, right above you? No, this is simply gives you a clue as to the subject matter. Yes. Now you may have just a few more housekeeping questions and we'll get down to business. You may be interested in knowing, those of you who do not already know, how the quarter grade will be computed. For those students who are in sections 3, 3A, 3B, 3C, you have five categories or five factors which will make up your quarter grade, and that is the Sullivan Report, the midterm examination, the periodical readings report, the Spitz Report, and the final examination. Those five grades will simply be added and divided by five. Those students who are students in sections 4, 4A, 4B, 4C have six factors making up their quarter grade, and those are the Sullivan Report, the midterm examination, the periodical readings report, the Spitz report, the final examination, and then the average of the quizzes, which you wrote in the Thursday or Friday afternoon discussion groups. In that case, the six grades will be added and divided by six. All right, I think that's it. Yes, Mr. Hofer? Just a little bit, just a little bit. Of course, you know the material for the final exam begins where the midterm examination left off. But the actual questions for the final examination, I'm saying this so that you needn't spend undue time reviewing the preliminary material. Concentrate beginning with material that deals with the theology of the Middle Ages. No, but you're welcome to look at them. They're all up in my office. I'd say perhaps the best time to do that would be early next quarter. And once we get, it looks like a publishing house right now. We have piles and piles. We're trying to get them all in order so that we can keep grades separate. But you're certainly welcome to see them after that. All right, the heading that you have, which is perhaps not altogether intelligible to those of you who are in the rear, reads, From Luther to Lutheranism, : Augsburg. In other words, the Augsburg Confession at the Diet of Augsburg, 1530. Mr. Outing had expressed the wish that in this last lecture, after we had finished the stint, courtesy of Dr. Meyer, on the English Reformation, that we make an attempt at least to at least bring the students up to the Diet of Augsburg. And there's real wisdom in that suggestion, particularly since you ought to know at least some of the historical background concerning the Augsburg Confession, even though you may not have read the Augsburg Confession prior to your going out for summer vicarages, not to mention other equally important reasons. All right. Under A, I've written, the Augsburg Confession is partly effective and partly symbolic of the transition from Luther to Lutheranism. What I mean to say by that is that the Augsburg Confession has partly brought about, has partly effected the transition itself, and to some extent only symbolizes the transition from what seemed to have been the private religious experiences of a solitary individual, name of Martin Luther, to a movement, on the other hand, or, if you will, you may even call it to a church, on the other hand, church in the modern denominational sense of the word. This was a rather Herculean task. I hardly need to remind you of that. It's awfully easy, I suppose, when we, who are called Lutherans, gather together and think back to the Turm Erlebnis, for example, of Martin Luther, to think that when he went through these struggles in the cloister, that's when the Lutheran Church was born. Well, it's no such thing. At this point, nothing could have been remoter to him than the notion of a separate church body or a separate Christian communion. And even after the posting of the 95 Theses, All this was done, of course, within the bosom of the Roman Church. And if, even after he was excommunicated, and after he fell under the ban of the emperor, there was nothing even approximating what you and I may conceive of as the Church of the Augsburg Confession, or the Lutheran Church. It took a lot of doing, in other words, and it took at least a decade before what happened to this monk turned out to be happening to thousands and thousands of fellow confessing Christians who shared his confession of faith and were gradually constituted as the Churches of the Augsburg Confession. Now, for this transition from Martin Luther himself to what we might call the Lutheran Churches or the Lutheran Church or Lutheranism, I am saying that you can look to the Augsburg Confession as symbolic of the transition and to some extent as having actually achieved that transition, perhaps as dramatically as any other single factor did. All right, next. What was the issue at the Diet of Augsburg? This was a diet of the Holy Roman Empire. It met in Germany, in Augsburg, in that year, in 1530. And you can well be sure that the purpose for which this diet was convoked by Emperor Charles V was not that he wanted a diet which would draft a charter for the Lutheran churches. He was not trying to write a manifesto, a theological manifesto of the Lutheran Reformation. Nothing could have been farther from his thinking than that. One of his questions was the question, what shall we do about this rumbling that's going on in Germany? He hadn't even thought of it as a Reformation. And that was indeed one of the issues at the Diet of Augsburg, how to contain this movement, or if necessary, how to crush it. But a predominant problem which occupied the concern of those who were gathered at Augsburg in 1530 was a political, military, economic question confronting the entire empire. And that was the question, what to do about the threat of the Turk. Which now hung like a shadow over Western Europe. Just as that same threat from the same Turk hung like a shadow a century earlier over the eastern part of the empire, over Eastern Europe. Now, the relations between Charles V and the Pope were at this time less than ideal in view of the fact that only 3 years previous to this, in 1527, the Emperor's armies had sacked Rome. The Emperor was having difficulty not only with the Pope, but perhaps even more blatantly with King Francis of France. This was a nip and tuck struggle for power between them. At the same time, the independent princes of Germany, or the increasingly independent princes of Germany, were trying more and more to assert their independence of imperial control. And to make matters worse, these upstart princes from Germany were exploiting, were making use of this outlawed heretic, Martin Luther, as their excuse for their rebellion against the empire. He was their man. He had been put under the imperial ban. They were now going to throw around their weight and to assert their liberty from the imperial domination ostensibly out of protest against the way in which their man Martin Luther had been handled by the empire. The fact is pretty transparent that this was an excuse, a kind of ecclesiastical, polite excuse for them to do what they wanted to do anyway on political and economic grounds. Now, it was this political fact, with a bit of theological window dressing, and this brings me to point C, this political fact with its theological window dressing, which brings Martin Luther to the Diet of Augsburg. The very fact that the German princes were at least pretending that Martin Luther was the issue between Emperor Charles V on the one hand and the princely German concerns on the other hand is what set up the occasion for Emperor Charles V to give the Lutherans and Luther himself a hearing. Well, as you know, Luther himself never got there. He was deliberately kept away because he was under the ban. If he'd gone, he, 9 chances out of 10, would never have returned alive. And let's say a word under capital letter C now about Charles V, no theologian. Here I simply want to underscore once more that not only was the Diet of Augsburg not primarily a theological diet, but the emperor who convoked the diet was also no theologian. Even his most sympathetic biographers could not make this claim for him. He was not, in other words, the sort of politician theologian which Justinian had been, for example, in the 6th century. The finer points of theological debate which transpired at Augsburg seemed to interest him not at all. He fell asleep during the reading of the Augustana very early in the reading, and lest you think that this betrays a prejudice on his part against the Lutherans in favor of the Roman Church, it must be said in all fairness to Charles V that he also slept through the Roman Consultatio. There's good documentation for that fact. And as I said, not only didn't these fine points of theological discussion concern him, it was also not theological concerns primarily which brought him to Augsburg in the first place. He came to Augsburg because of the combination of threats which I enumerated just a moment ago, the threat of the Turk, which hung like a shadow over Western Europe, the opposition from Francis of France, and from the German princes. Now, I suppose it's almost a truism for me to say that of the opposition groups which were hailed to Augsburg, it was the German Lutherans, which were most vulnerable in the emperor's eyes from a theological point of view, not to mention the Turks. But of course, they weren't there to defend themselves, and they couldn't have cared less. And so for that reason, because the German princes themselves had made a theological issue, as I said, out of what was basically a political one, and therefore, at least formally, their theological complaints had to be respected. And because Luther himself, by this time, as you know, had been excommunicated as a heretic and was under the ban, and there was the plea from the German princes that the case be reopened. Therefore, the permission was granted that the German Lutheran churches should present at the Diet of Augsburg a summary of their teachings and of their faith. and it was that which provided the immediate occasion for the Augustana. Now, they weren't asked simply to make a report. Whatever report they were to make was, of course, to come under judgment. And so this was, in the age-old sense of the word, this was indeed an apology. I don't mean yet that symbol in the Book of Concord, which we call the Apology of the Augsburg Confession. But even the Augsburg Confession itself, the original Augustana of 1530, was called an apologia, recalling the same word which was used, with reference to the witness of the early martyrs. The Lutherans from Germany at Augsburg in 1530 were very definitely on the defensive. They were not simply there making a sociological report on what Lutherans teach, but in their saying, this is what we believe, teach, and confess, they were submitting their confession of faith to the test of orthodoxy. It was a confessio in the traditional sense of the word. I will confess thy name before kings and princes, and will not be ashamed. Whosoever confesses me before men, him will I confess before my heavenly Father. It was a confession in that sense of the word, and they never doubted it for a moment. Now the whole question, and this brings me to the next point, D, who were the innovators and who were the Catholics at Augsburg? Well, the Empire and the Roman Church, of course, were agreed that the Lutherans were the innovators, and took it as self-evident that they were Catholic. Whereas the Lutheran confessors said it was just the reverse that was the case. It was the medieval church which constituted an innovation, a departure from the church of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and that which we believe, teach, and confess in our churches is but one holy Catholic and apostolic faith. It is the church, the gospel of the church in all generations and in all places. But it's not just a matter of saying this back and forth across the abyss in a polemical, highly charged situation like Augsburg. Quite another thing to prove the case. Prove the case that it was the Romans who were the innovators and that the German Lutherans were the Catholics, as they maintained. But it wasn't a new question. This was a question which had plagued the Reformation ever since the very beginning of Martin Luther's reformatory career. And one of the favorite polemical and rhetorical devices which Luther's opponents had exercised against him was to hang about his neck labels which originally belonged to classical heresies in the history of the church. He had been called everything from an Arian, recalling the 4th century in your fall quarter course, to a Hussite, recalling some of the remarks which Mr. Otting made to you about the 15th century. So you see, this business of labels or libels was not new with our generation. We speak about reactionaries or conservatives and liberals. That's rather tame compared to calling a man an Arian or a Hussite. Luther wasn't always awfully polished and smooth and shrewd in this business of name calling. Not only did he retaliate in kind, but that sometimes he was blissfully naive enough to accept the label. And as you know, for a long time, well, at least for a period of 2 or 3 years, in this decade of the 30s, he had almost been seduced into thinking that he was a Hussite. And, well, even to his very, very late years in his career, there were points on which he very adamantly defended Jan Hus, But he did come to see, at least by this time, by the time of Augsburg, that on many fundamental points he and Hus were not agreed. Although he fully expected that any day, any week, he would wind up the way Hus did, a cinder. And for much the same reason. Well, so this is the way the charges were hurled back and forth. Who were the innovators and who were the Catholics? And as I say, Luther's Roman opponents either said explicitly that this was an innovation, or they said it was the kind of innovation which had earlier precedents in the history of heresy, all the way from Arianism to Hussitism. On the contrary, said the Lutherans, the shoe belongs on the other foot, and they turned the tables. The real innovations are those which have been perpetrated upon the church by the Roman opposition. And therefore, the Lutheran confessors at Augsburg refused to concede the name Catholic to their opponents, for it was they said, who indeed were defending the universal Catholic faith. This is an argument, as I said, which had been dating back to the Leipzig debate of 1519. There already, Luther said that this was a Catholic theology standing up in protest against one which paraded itself as Catholic but wasn't at all. All right. Point E. Melanchthon as the author. At Augsburg, you've got the Lutheran position achieving perhaps its most decisive and its finest literary formulation. And ironically, the author of the confession wasn't Luther. Was his younger colleague, Philip Melanchthon. At least the immediate author, the one who actually put the ink on the paper, was Melanchthon, and put the theological position into its explicit words as we have them today, was Philip Melanchthon. Melanchthon was more learned than Luther, at least in the sense that he was better informed on a wider range of subjects. He was also, and this is not necessarily a tribute to him, he was also more ironic than Luther was. In the long haul, it was this feature about Philip Melanchthon that proved to be his downfall, and the downfall of all those who went with him. As a scholar, at Augsburg, he very firmly believed, if he firmly believes anything, forget that I said that. He believed a great deal of passion that what was needed between Rome and the reformers, most of all, was clarity. If you could just clarify what the theological issues were, then while this may not remove the opposition altogether, it would remove large areas, at least, of misunderstanding between them. And there is much to be said for this position of Melanchthon's. And at least in 1530, this was still a providential boon to the reformers to have a man who was ironic in the right places. He really conceded nothing yet at this point, and it was good to have his kind of logical skill, his rhetorical abilities, and his vast learning. And for the most part, he still enjoyed the widespread confidence and trust of the princes and the other theologians who were present at Augsburg. There has been a bit of an irony that Martin Luther, who could be so tempestuous, who could get so impatient with young Philip. It's interesting to read the correspondence that Luther carries on with Philip while Philip was at Augsburg, warning Philip that his slow-going, easy-going timidity toward the Romans was bound to fail, that for all of his Irenicism, he was bound to be disappointed in the end. And it was none other than Philip Melanchthon who, in the end, admitted that Luther had been right. Luther says, you can't get the Pope and me, Dr. Martin, under the same hat. And you're going to learn that by hard experience. And Philip did. Well, the Augustana, the Confessio Augustana, shows that finally there was no attempt at compromise. So there is an ironic spirit, particularly in Articles 1, 2, and 3. We'll come to that in just a moment. But Philip regretted the excesses to which the argument so far had led both sides in their heated controversies. And he sought to bring the calm and the clarity of the scholar to the issues. He didn't want to compromise, but he did want to conciliate. Meanwhile, you have Luther at a far distance because he had been banned, chafing at the bit, yet not being able to be on the scene to play the field marshal. He did a lot of corresponding in those days, burned up the mail. And so, consequently, the task of composing what we call the Augsburg Confession fell to the lot primarily of Philip Melanchthon. He would have preferred, as he says, a much more exhaustive discussion, at least of the mooted issues in the doctrinal controversy. He would like to have written something as exhaustive, as systematic, as lengthy as his later apology to the Augsburg Confession turned out to be. But the other confessors at Augsburg simply wouldn't let him. As it was, you look at the Augsburg Confession and imagine how long that must have taken to read, especially to a drowsy emperor. What he had to do as he composed this confessio, and this too I think is a blessing in retrospect, he was under obligation to formulate a confession of faith which would indeed represent that which was believed, taught, and confessed by the Lutheran churches. They didn't say, Philip, you're the theologian, you go and write what you think we ought to be believing. And so here Melanchthon was under the discipline of being a confessor for the confession of the church. He wasn't writing as a young theological prodigy. This is not the private confession of Philip Melanchthon. All right, predecessors of the Augsburg Confession, point S. In his composition of the Augustana, Melanchthon relied very heavily on some previously formulated documents. Particularly three, the Marburg Articles, M-A-R-B-U-R-G, the Schwabach, S-C-H-W-A-B-A-C-H, the Schwabach Articles, and the Torgau, T-O-R-G-A-U, and the Torgau Articles. These documents had been prepared in preceding years. On similar occasions, by the way, on earlier occasion, there was need for Lutherans to formulate what it was they were believing and teaching. They rose to the occasion in the form of those articles which I've just now enumerated, either in distinguishing their position from that of Rome, or in distinguishing their position from other segments of the Reformation. You also have at Augsburg what you might call a via media, a middle way, a Republican Party, and it found its way into the Augsburg Confession. And there it is. If you are interested in the kind of Formgeschichte which traces out sources, you can find the fragments of the Torgau or of the Schwabach or the Marburg articles or the influence of the Middle of the Road Party, which all found their way through this filter of Philip Melanchthon's own brilliant theological mind into the Augustana itself. And this all came to voice. And Lutherans would say in a very harmonious voice in the Augsburg Confession. What it had the effect of doing was to place Lutheranism in the context of the world church. It said what it was that Lutheranism stood for, in distinction from or in agreement with other sectors of the Holy Catholic Church. And in this way, and that's what I said before, in this way, Lutheranism became a church in the modern denominational sense of the word. Perhaps just one last note under this point, and that is that since the Augsburg Confession had these very clear predecessors, it was, in a sense, a Melanchthonian montage of these previous articles of Torgau and Schwabach and Marburg. For that reason, Martin Luther could say, even though he had not himself been at Augsburg, he could say that the Augsburg Confession is mine. For indeed, he had had a very vast and a powerful hand in formulating these previous confessional documents, not to mention the influence which he wielded upon Melanchthon through the correspondence in 1530. All right, next of all, G, the initial agreements. Now, by initial agreements, I'm not talking about agreements between the Lutherans and the Roman Catholics in debate. What I am calling attention to is that in the Augsburg Confession itself, particularly in Articles 1, 2, and 3, the emphasis lies heavily upon those things which the Lutherans and the Romans had in common. The three doctrines which these three articles represent, respectively, are the doctrine of God, the doctrine of man, and the doctrine of Christ. Now, to be sure, corresponding to each one of these doctrines, De Deo, De Homine, De Christo, corresponding to each one of these and corresponding to each one of these articles, there had been, and this is the irony, there had been strong controversial differences between Rome and Lutheranism. And historians looking back might feel surprised at encountering the ironic tone of Articles 1, 2, and 3 of the Augustana. And still, despite the differences which have been raging between Rome and Lutheranism on these three doctrines, nevertheless, when you look at these three articles themselves, you can't help but be amazed at the conservatism of the tone of the articles themselves. For example, the Doctrine de Deo concerning God in Article 1 is cast in terminology which could just as easily have been formulated in the medieval period by any Orthodox scholastic theologian. Article 2 on the Doctrine of Men treats the whole problem of sin in terms of a theological distinction which had been current all the way through the Middle Ages. A theological distinction regarding the nature of sin, which is omnipresent in all the scholastic manuals. Article 3, and this one perhaps you know by heart, Article 3 deals with the doctrine of Christ, how, by the simple device of summarizing what the Apostles' Creed has to say on the subject. So on these three very pivotal doctrines, you have a tone and a wording, and indeed a theological stance adopted, which would quickly appeal to the Roman opposition. I don't know whether this was undertaken this way for strategic purposes, but it did have a strategic effect, because when the Romans heard this, they were overwhelmed. They didn't think there could be such agreement between the two parties. All right. H, the rock of offense. Maybe Articles 1, 2, and 3 were what the rhetoricians would call a captatio benevolentia. You flatter your audience, you win his confidence in the opening section of your speech, and then when you've got him relaxed and at ease, you hit him in the solar plexus. Well, this is what happens with Article 4. Here you have this wide expanse of ironic tone and obvious theological agreement between the two opposing parties in Articles 1, 2, and 3. And Article 4, the skies fall in all of a sudden. And this was not for rhetorical effect. Here, Philip Melanchthon, even if he had wanted to, and I suspect that he did not want to, couldn't have mollified his tone at all. For here the opposition was stark. And I suppose, for the most part, the opposition has remained stark all the way into the present-day church situation. Article 4, in other words, is the article on the crucial doctrine of justification. On the crucial doctrines of the Trinity, on the nature of sin, even on the doctrine of original sin, the confessors at Oxford were willing to adopt a very conciliatory tone. But when it came to the doctrine of justification by faith, they had to make very, very clear, and Melanchthon was completely a party to this program, they had to make very, very clear that it wasn't a problem in semantics. It was not a breakdown in communications. It was not a misunderstanding which could be resolved by a scholar's efforts at clarification of terms, but that what was finally at stake, as the Augustana says over and over again throughout Article 4, is the very gospel itself. Or, as Melanchthon was to say so frequently later on in the apology to the Augsburg Confession, what was at stake were the benefits of Christ and the consolation of sore and afflicted consciences. Now, 400 years ago this year, 1564, 34 years after the Augsburg Confession was read to Emperor Charles V, the canons and decrees of the Council of Trent were published at Rome. At the session number 6 at Trent, the Tridentine Fathers had tried to deal with a kind of counterstatement to Article 4 of the Augustana on justification. And as I said to you once before, it's a splendid exercise for young evangelical theologians to read what the Council of Trent had to say in Session 6, De Justificatione. Especially if someone were to say, I'll give you 10 minutes after you have finished reading the Canons and Decrees of Session 6 for you to tell me what's wrong with the Tridentine doctrine of justification. And the wheels of your brain really have to turn in a hurry to put your finger on the nub of the issue. I point this out again, at the risk of being wearisome, in order to say that Trent did try, at least there were some factions in the smoke-filled rooms and the corridors behind the scenes at Trent, who did try, as well as they could, to compromise, or at least to conciliate in some way or another, the issue between Rome and the Lutherans on the crucial doctrine of justification. And yet, after all is said and done, and you stack Article 4 of the Augustana against Session 6 of Trent, the same issues to which the Augustana called attention, the basic issues which divided them as a rock of offense, a stone of stumbling, remain. And they remain to this day. For, as I said, and here I'm only repeating what the Augustana confessor said, what was at issue in the article concerning justification was the very truth and the very power and the very joy and the very life of the gospel itself. It was for this reason that the confessors were able to go down the road as far as they did with Rome in Articles 1, 2, and 3. Only because they knew what they had to say in Article 4. And on this there was neither conciliation nor compromise. All right, point I. The hub and the spokes, this is a metaphor which I adopt from Dr. Walter, his lectures on law and gospel. This doesn't come from the Augsburg Confession itself. Dr. Walter says at one point in his evening lectures to the seminarians on law and gospel that the hub of the theological wheel in the Book of Concord, or for that matter in the Christian faith itself, is the doctrine of justification by faith alone. Even if that term is only a bit of shorthand to describe all the other ways in which the New Testament tries to put it, you don't have to use the forensic metaphors of justification. You can use all the other metaphors of sacrifice or redemption or new creation or adoption or what have you. Or Jesus as friend of sinners. However you put it, sooner or later, and it's this way that the Lutheran confessions picture the thing, the doctrine of justification doesn't refer only to this forensic, largely Pauline metaphor, but it's a summary of the whole soteriology of the New Testament. And Dr. Walter said, this is the hub of the theological wheel, or the hub of the Christian faith. All the other doctrines, whether it be the doctrine concerning sin, or the doctrine concerning election, or the doctrine concerning the sacrament, radiate from this hub as spokes do. Now, he carried the metaphor a step farther and said, and the spokes have a rim, which keep them in place on the outer edges, and that is the old Lutheran hermeneutical principle of the proper distinction between law and gospel. Now, something of this metaphor, however, is anticipated in the Augustana. And even if it weren't said explicitly, as it is, that the article of justification is determinative of all the other doctrines, it would nevertheless still be apparent from the way in which the subsequent articles after Article 4 take their own cues from what was previously said about justification by faith. For example, and we would do well as Lutherans today to read this and reread this, Article 5. On the doctrine of the Word. There is no Lutheran confessional doctrine of the Word, if you take Article 5 seriously, except that it is made to depend on Article 4, on the doctrine concerning the nature of the gospel. All right. More power to you tomorrow, and I would spell power with a capital T.